You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
tell people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell me.
People.
You gotta take a look at yourself, yeah. Get some people.
Where do you wanna be?
Where you wanna be?
Tell me what your life is.
What's with your life?
Running like a red disease.
Running like a red disease. Ghetto people.
Stop giving up yourself.
Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, yeah. You got to learn to love yourself.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God, for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity. Everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future, we all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe. Civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted. And we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and in honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashe. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Baba Oshi Hotep family. Hope everything was well with you today. Hope you had a great weekend. Hope you had a chance to do all the things you want to do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And hope the weather was accommodating for you to do it. But of course, if it was not, and it had to get done, you got it done because you don't procrastinate. You get things done. That's why we love you, appreciate you. Continue to do so, brothers and sisters. Get things done. Yes. You're listening to African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. At the top of the page, you'll see podcast. Click on that. The drop down, you'll see African Perspectives. Click on that, and there will be programs that are dated and titled. But of course, you can easily go to whoever, your browser is, Google, whoever, and put in babaoshi.net, babaoshi.net. And once again, there will be programs that are dated and titled. I tell you, this is always a good day that when we can get Baba Rudy on the horn with us, and we're going to forego the announcements and everything like that, so we can afford him as much time, and then you too, as our listeners, afford him as much time you can get to ask questions and state your comments or concerns. Baba Baruti, good morning.
Yes, sir. Good evening, Baba Oshi. How you doing? You're doing well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, much better, brother.
you're sounding good. You're sounding better than me, if I can say that.
Man, indeed. I'm feeling much better. Well, hey, I'm always hyped when I know I got you on. I got the chance to have you on the program, brother. I'm really always hype. Oh, but let me do this first. See, okay. Man, you got me discombobulated. Let me do what I always do every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday around this time after I make those announcements. I read the Enye Sesem of Daily Revolutionary Thought. So I read the day before and the day of, and on Fridays I read Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. See, so I'm trying to make sure I keep every day that there's something that is inspirational that our brothers and sisters quote, and then you, of course, expound on. So March, thank you. March 13th. What do I care about death in cause of redemption of Africa? I would die anywhere in the cause of liberation, Ashe. A real man dies but once, but a coward dies 1,000 times before his real death. The Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. There is no doubt that we are witnessing the fall of the Western Empire. The question is whether or not we are really prepared. Are we waiting for anarchy to pave the way by fractionalizing Europeans from the inside and then begin to consider our options with incompletely re-Africanized minds? Or are we doing self-liberating work while they destroy themselves? These tireless, brave warriors urging us towards spiritual, psychological, physical, and mental preparedness must be our dominant voice. The option of liberation must be made available to the ears of every awakening African. When voices rise from our African center, there should be a movement in the direction of those voices to secure and protect them.
Every effort must be made to ensure that they are not silenced by external or externally governed internal forces. We know our enemies. We know their methods for suppressing and silencing those who courageously guide our righteous rage through their words and actions. Our children are afraid to be African because they have read of and witnessed these murders. That this can no longer be the case. Affirm, I am willing to die in the cause of our liberation. I say, affirm, I am willing to die in the cause of our liberation. March 14th. The necessary re-education of Africans and possibly in a possible solution of racial or cultural crises can begin. Strangely enough, only when Africans fully realize this central fact in their lives that the white man, the European, the Caucasian, the Yorugu is their bitter enemy. Dr. Chancellor Williams. Racial oppression or oppression period does not require a distance between the perpetrator and the victim. A racist can sleep every night with whom she or he rationalizing inferioritizes and exploits. Insecure, unstable males sleep with the wives and girlfriends they physically abuse. Deranged parents and guardians often provide clean, trendy, ample spaces in their residence for the children they mentally, physically, and sexually exploit. This is the nature of the psycho and psychopaths. They keep their trophies. In practice, racist oppression works best in intimate, personally controlled environments, and even better when the victims believe the racist is not racist, i.e., the racist love them, is doing it for their own good, and they themselves cause this abuse on themselves. European tactics encourage keeping the enemy even closer than friends. When you get down to basics, the most enduring racist acts committed by Europeans have been covert in the closest of company. They have been kept out of public sight while Europeans continue to systematically work to maintain an extreme unequal distribution of group power. Affirm, my enemy is my enemy, nothing more, nothing less. Affirm, my enemy is my enemy, nothing more, nothing less. The Enye Sesem of Daily Revolutionary Thought. Ashe? Ashe, Ashe, brother. Yes, sir. How you feeling, man?
I'm doing good. I'm listening to you, you know, speak the words of two of our most important warrior ancestor warrior scholars.
Yes, definitely. You know? Yes.
And it's like when we live here, the idea that what is no longer here or what was yesterday is no longer relevant to what's going on. I can't think of any two voices, even though, of course, there are many, many others, but I can't think of any two, any voices that are more relevant than those two in terms of what's going on now.
Yes.
And of how I'm feeling today.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, this is a magnificent day. This is a beautiful day. This
yes,
is
it
the
is.
Day we get to do more work.
Yeah.
You know,
raise more consciousness.
We're here to do this.
That's right. Raise more consciousness. Well, you know, when you told me that some time ago, and you reiterated that on my program, how important the work that I'm doing, and I appreciate that. I really do, and that encourages me, and that's why I try every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Monterey, 10 Pacific, to be on the air. Because this is not a show. I don't call it – this is a program because I'm trying to put something on our minds. I'm trying to help us understand it so we can step outside – those boundaries that these Caucasians, these Yorugus have placed on us to look at them for who and what they are. Not that we challenge them, the hell with them, but we challenge ourselves. You know, that's right. Yeah.
See, we are only competition.
Yeah.
See, I am my own only competition, and even though we do need to be clear, which you reiterate every time, we do need to be clear that they are enemy, that they are the source of our destruction, that they have been closest, even though they may not be the only ones. As not John Clark said, we have no friends.
That's right.
But still, this is our primary oppositional force right now. This is the primary force that got us to where we are today, to, you know, say Arthur Schomburg told John Clark, you know, you need to go and study them to find out why we're in the position that we're in today.
Mm-hmm.
even though we need to know that, we need to not forget that. You know, you have some people saying, you know, don't, or we keep, you know, going over that and that again, because we forget, because we quickly forget. We've been trained to forget.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we shouldn't remember, but the bulk of our energy should be placed on building, on nation building, on re-Africanization, on recognizing our genius and applying it to ensovereigning African people. That's where the bulk of our energy goes, and a lot of us get caught, especially when we're, I say, new to this or coming into this or in some cases actually out of fear or what have you, don't do anything or don't want to do anything, so they spend forever talking about what's been done to us and what's being done to us. And that to me is crystal clear. It needs to be part of the discussion, but that should be crystal clear. Like you said, the bulk of our work, the bulk of our energy needs to be on what needs to be done. And of course, I'm always going to reference Nana Amos M. Wilson, one of our finest warrior ancestor scholar, Jegna, that, you know, where are our pyramids? Where are those? You know, we talk about this great past, and it's accurate, but, you know, you're supposed to use history, our story, as the springboard to what needs to be created now, so that 7, 10, 15, 70 generations from now, folks will look back and they will say, okay, those were warriors. Those were Africans who understood they were African. Those were Africans who understood the concept of enemy and were able to identify their enemy and not spend forever talking about it, but acting on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, we have to have our spokespeople, people who can articulate verbally and on paper our situation and what needs to be done. And of course, those are always going to be the enemy's targets, but we have to have those, because for people who begin to wake up, there has to be, I don't want to say a siren's call, that's negative, there has to be a lighthouse, there has to be a light that they can see, that they can walk toward.
Right.
And that also is a very dangerous job, which I believe every time, pretty much every time I've come to the end of your program, I've said the point that, you know, what you do, people say, oh, you know, he's just on there talking. No, what you do is a very dangerous job, because voices are what enemies target, because they know those voices can wake people up, people who otherwise would stay completely and totally asleep. But when you have those voices in the mix or in the midst, then you have an enormous potential for people to come to self-realization, self-awareness, and act against what's being done to them. And, of course, those voices, enemies need to silence those voices. So people really, 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 I firmly believe, need to understand the pivotal role that you play in this, those like you play, because, of course, you're not the only one, but you're one of my favorites. The voices like yours that, you know, you're just doing your work. And I know this isn't a let's phrase Baba Oshi Day, but it's like you're doing the work that you were brought here to do. And I doubt very seriously if you are concerned with consequences.
At none at all.
This is what you would call here to do.
None at all.
You know,
I'm so seriously.
That needs to be in this context, in this alien context, in this anti-African context, that needs to be taken in consideration when people turn on and listen to you.
Yeah, well, I'm committed. I had been on radio back in Milwaukee in a various program.
Okay, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, me and a brother had a radio program on Wednesday once a week on this other brother's terrestrial radio station, you know, and the general manager said, get them cats off my radio, man. We ain't gonna be able to get any advertisement, man.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, get these cats off.
That's life.
Yeah. So, We were on for about a month, month and a half, something like that. But I
used to. And you got to somebody within that month and a half.
Yeah.
But my D's.
But I understand.
Quick. Yeah. That was Gwendolyn Brooks that said that something like most people can't deal with truth tellers. They prefer candy.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, lie to me.
Absolutely.
Because I'm just like what Colonel Nathan Jessup said in Few Good Men, played by Jack Nicholson. I can't handle the truth. Because that's what they can't, man. But one of the things I wanted to, us to talk about, you know, I did a program a couple of times. You know, this would be my eighth year in October. Of having it spread, yeah, and I'll go as until I'm to whatever happens, you know. But you know, I've done a program about words and the meaning of words from our perspective. I don't give a damn because see, in this society, you know, a lot of words have multiple meanings, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, what we have done with words is we flipped the script on some words, like you know, that's hot, or that's cold, that's cool, you know, in our slang, you know. But there's some words that are said that imply and or give an image that, unfortunately for us, continues to, like we continue to call ourselves slaves. If we would call ourselves captives, that flips the script and that puts the onus back on those captors, on the Caucasians, you know. But we continue to call ourselves, I mean, learned people, people in media and so forth. The slaves. I kept hearing it this last few weeks. The slaves, the slaves. We were not slaves. We were not slaves. We were captives. You know? A slave is somebody or something that submits its will to a master. We've never submitted. It is proven. We resisted. We fought on the continent, on the, you know, and so, you know, but another one is.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Another one is I sent you the piece that my good friend, Brother Research West, sent me on Smokey Robinson, wanting to insist that, you know, he's black and he's not African. Don't want to use African. In fact, many of those people who say that, they take the context that people who call themselves African after you've been here, that's over. You're not African, you know. Mm-hmm. And the people in Africa don't want you either. They wouldn't recognize you, you know.
Right.
See,
right.
And so, yeah. And there's a lot of that because
no, go ahead, Bob.
Okay, thank you. There's a lot of that because I just watched the three episodes of Everything is Going to Be All White.
Okay.
And this documentary is on Showtime. They have a lot of comedians and they have a lot of learned people and resource people talking in the documentary. But the reaction has been, I mean, visceral, man. I mean, especially from us. We are talking about this documentary. Oh, this is racism. We apparently we don't know what racism is.
Absolutely.
We don't. You know? And this, I mean, they're bringing historical context. Yes, some of them are saying some things. They're trying to be funny and so forth. But they're bringing some true historical context. And they're saying, no, that's, you know, when you're trying to divide people, you're trying to alien. Man, see, and so I've been battling with myself about that in these last few weeks because I'm seeing not that the Caucasians say, I know what they're going to say because they're already talking about critical race theory and try to challenge that and don't have a damn clue of really what it is. But the bottom line is we don't want you to teach history. We don't want you to say what really happened. We want to control the narrative and we want to say this is what happened. They want to sugarcoat it, candy coat it. See, that's the real deal on that. But the reality is that this situation is deep. And so I'm going to play what I shared with you that Brother Wes sent to me with Smokey. And so the listening audience can hear it and then we'll gain some dialogue. And of course, we want the listening audience to, you know, to chime in when they can. If they want
Absolutely.
To, yeah, you know. So this is the piece, and I heard this, Baba, when it aired on Deaf Poetry, on HBO's Dev Poetry. I heard it. I heard it, and it left me feeling some kind of way, man, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, it left me feeling some kind of way, too.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I like Smokey, although, you know, I know entertainers. I don't put my faith in entertainers in terms of being conscious, you know. But but when he was insistent, you know, and so forth, it kind of left me some kind of way, man. So we're going to play this thing on Smokey here, and I want the brothers and sisters, you know, to and you give us, of course, I want your perspective on this, and then, of course, the brothers and sisters can chime in. This is Def Poetry about 18 years ago, and he's being introduced by Mos Def, and let's check it out.
Def Poetry, please give it up for Smokey Robinson.
I love being black. I love being called black. I love being an American. I love being a black American. But as a black man in this country, I think it's a shame that every few years we get a change of name. Since those first ships arrived here from Africa that came across the sea, there were already black men in this country who were free. And as for those who came over on those terrible boats, they were called nigger and slave and told what to do and how to behave. And then Master started tripping, doing his midnight tipping down to the slave shacks where he forced he and great-great-grandma to be together. And if great-great-grandpa protested, he got tarred and feathered. And at the same time, the black men in the country who were free were mating with the tribes like the Apache and the Cherokee. And as a result of all that, we're a parade of every shade. And at this late day and age, you can be sure there ain't too many of us in this country whose bloodline is pure. But according to a geological, geographical genealogy study published in Time magazine, the black African people were the first on the scene. So for what it's worth, the black African people were the first on Earth, and through migration, our characteristics started to change and rearrange to adapt to whatever climate we migrated to. And that's how I became me, and you became you. So if we're going to go back, let's go all the way back. And if Adam was black and Eve was black, then that kind of makes it a natural fact that everybody in America is an African American. Everybody in Europe is an African European. Everybody in the Orient is an African Asian, and so on and so on. That is, if the origin of man is what we're going to go on. And if one drop of black blood makes you black like they say, then everybody's black anyway. So quit trying to change my identity. I'm already who I was meant to be. I'm a black American born and raised. And Brother James Brown wrote a wonderful phrase. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Because I'm proud to be black. And I ain't never lived in Africa. And because my great-great-granddaddy on my daddy's side did, don't mean I want to go back. Now, I have nothing against Africa. It's where some of the most beautiful places and people in the world are found. But I've been blessed to go a lot of places in this world. And if you ask me where I choose to live, I pick America, hands down. Yeah. Now, by and by, we were called Negroes. And after a while, that name was banished. Anyway, Negro is just how you say black in Spanish. Then we were called colored. But shit, everybody's one color or another. And I think it's a shame that we hold that against each other. And it seems like we reverted back to a time when being called black was an insult. Even if it was another black man who said that a fight would result, because we've been so brainwashed that black was wrong till even the yellow niggas and the black niggas couldn't get along. But then came the 1960s, when we struggled and died to be called equal in black, and we walked with pride with our heads held high and our shoulders pushed back, and black was beautiful. But I guess that wasn't good enough, because now I had to come with some other stuff. Who comes up with this shit anyway? Was it one or a group of niggas just sitting around one day? Feeling a little insecure again about being called black and decided that African-American sounded a little more exotic. Well, I think you were being a little more neurotic. It's that same mentality that got Amos and Andy put off the air because they were embarrassed about the way the character spoke. And as a result of that action, a lot of wonderful black actors ended up broke. When we were just laughing and having fun about ourselves. So I say, fuck you if you can't take a joke. You didn't see the Beverly Hillbillies being protested by white folks. And if you think, of course you think, that being called African-American sets all black people's minds at ease, since we affectionately call each other nigger, I affectionately say to you, nigger, please. I didn't get a chance to vote on who I'd like to be. Who gave you the right to make that decision for me? I ain't under your rule or in your dominion, and I'm entitled to my own opinion. Now, there are some African Americans here, but they recently moved here from places like Kenya, Ethiopia, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Zaire. But not a brother whose family's lived in this country for generations, occupying space in all the locations, New York, Miami, L.A., Detroit, Chicago, even if he's wearing a dashiki and sporting an afro. And if you go to Africa in search of your race, you'll find out quick you're not an African-American. You're just a black American in Africa taking up space. Why you keep trying to attach yourself to a continent where even if you got the chance to go and you went, most people there wouldn't even claim you as one of them, as a purebred daughter or son of them. Your heritage is right here now, no matter what you call yourself or what you say. And a lot of people died to make it that way. And if you think America's the leader on inequality and suffering and grieving, how come there's so many people coming and so few leaving? Rather than all this fine thought with America shit you promoting, if you want to change something, use your privilege. Get to the polls. Come and support them. God knows we've earned the right to be called American Americans and be free at last. And rather than you moving forward with progress, you're dwelling in the past. We struggled too long. We've come too far. And to the folks that know who we were, let's be proud of who we are. We're the only people whose name is always a trend. When is this shit going to end? Look at all the different colors of our skin. Black is not our color. It's our core. It's what we've been living and fighting and dying for. But if you choose to be called African-American and that's your preference, then I give you that reference. But I know on this issue I don't stand alone on my own. And if I do, then let me be me. And I'd appreciate it if when you see me, you say, there goes a man who says it loud. I'm black. I'm black. I'm a black American and I'm proud. Because I love being an American. And I love being black. I love being called black. Yeah, I said it. And I don't take it back.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think, Baba?
It's painful for me to listen to.
It really is.
I guess the third time, because I hear Negro Logic. I remember the first time I heard a statement like that. It was Morgan Freeman, who had gone to the continent to, you know, do a film or whatever, and he said, "I don't recognize anything here that's got anything, you know, to do with me.
Right.
I don't see myself here." And it's I mean, you can look at it multiple ways. One of the ways for me is just this automatic denial. Why is that necessary? It's like a qualification to make Urugu feel comfortable with the fact that you're there and that you're not going to turn. I remember it was in the 70s, and I was in the it was done in the 70s, but I was in grad school when I found out about a survey that was done in the military. That was done primarily in the U.S. Army, but it was done in the military, where the question was, because they were, this was the time that they were beginning to consider the invasion and planning of bases and forts in Africa, and they were wondering, these Europeans who African people in this country had, you know, given loyalty to beyond any kind of words. And the survey was about whether Africans would fight against other Africans for the United States, as if the whole history of colonization, where Africans were inscripted to fight for Europeans, and some voluntarily so did that. But the idea of that, so it's like we are still in the process, even though that was, what, 18 years ago, whatever, that's no different than today. In fact, it's become, I would argue, even stronger today in terms of the opinion. That we still have to make a statement or make statements that make Urugu comfortable, that make them understand we still love you, that are said in defense of and exonerate Urugu for what they did. So for me, what I'm listening to is Menticide, extreme self-hatred and enemy love. That's what I hear.
Wow.
You know, and you've taken some words and you played around with them, and it sounded all nice, and there were, you know, bits and pieces of truth laced in there. But the whole idea, you know, for me, we got to get away from Africa. We got to get away from being called any kind of African whatsoever. We're who are the theorists who made it understood in psychology that for most Europeans and European science, black folks are just Europeans who have darker skin.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, I mean, we could be talking about this forever. This takes me back to, you know, the idea that we're all African, and I run into issues with this with some people, I guess. I think that needs to be seriously qualified. And yes, Africa is the origin of humanity, which, of course, being human is something that we need to deal with. We're dealing with Europeans, with Yorugu. But the idea that monolithic, well, I can't think of the word right now, but it's, I'll think of it in a second. But the idea that Africans, that all humanity came from one, you know,
one source. Person. Yeah, from one source.
Yeah, we misnamed her Lucy. But the, when we're looking at that, we're not looking at cultural development. We're not looking at civilization. We're not looking at how people develop differently. Even if we're not going to consider a Cro-Magnon thesis, even if we're not going to consider a Cro-Magnon thesis that Europeans originated in another kind of stock, another quote-unquote humanoid stock, even if we're not going to consider that, we have to still have to understand when you're talking about thousands and thousands of generations where there was separate people developing, then you have to understand that you have a development of a completely different type of personality. Ask folks, of course, to read Mama Rimba's Yorugu and consider that within the context of the Asili concept.
Yes.
But when you have that kind of development, then you have a whole different mind at work. So even if we're talking about from the same spot, monogenesis, that's the word I was looking for, the idea that everybody came through this one person, which I don't necessarily have an issue with. I don't necessarily have an issue with the Cro-Magnon thesis either, which I think was really, really spelled out quite well in a book called The Meaning of Blackness. But when you have that, so you have a mentality. We skip over so much basic stuff.
Yeah.
When you have a mentality that is the complete and total opposite of Ma'at, it's not just different. It's not just a variation of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the complete and total opposite of Ma'at, and whatever comes from the African sense of spirituality, if you will, that Europeans have taken hold of and promote as the way they are, there's no spirit attached to that.
Right.
So that allows you to be completely and totally contradicted, be completely and totally different. So to say that we're all one, you know, that we all came from there, doesn't really mean anything to me when you have the development of different people. You can just look at in families today. You might have two brothers born in the same family. One of them, you know, turns out to be a serious thug, criminal, et cetera, et cetera. Another one turns out to be, you know, a person who works in the community and feeds people in the community and takes care of all issues in the community and protects the children, et cetera, et cetera. And you have two completely different people that came with the same family. And if you took those two different people and they began to form societies, which became nations, and the societies and nations were designed around their interpretation of reality and the way that they saw morals and ethical behavior, et cetera, then you would have the development of two completely different mindsets. And if that growth, that development continued for millennia, then you have completely and totally different peoples relative to their mindset. So if you want to use that monogenesis theory, which you know, is usable, then we have to consider, because even Diop said, or Jope, even Jope said that we have to consider politics.
Right.
You know, and I say it's deeper than that, but we have to, he said we have to consider politics when we're looking at racial differences. Mm-hmm. Even if it was monogenesis and everybody originated from one people, one place, we have to consider what happened after that and the kind of mindset that these people have as a people, not as some individuals, but as a people. And what would make us be the leaders and the people who feel it is so imperative that we make them comfortable in their destruction of us? This is like the mind. Mm. You talk about we're not slaves. But that slave mentality, mm-hmm. and no, we weren't slaves. We were enslaved people. We were captives. We were held captive again. We were prisoners of war. But you have that slave mentality that was bred in a lot of us and became so successful in the self-hatred mm-hmm. of so many of us that it's become more and more the norm. Okay, you're seeing it more vocalized now than you did before. You're seeing more people fighting for this state of chaos, mm-hmm. for us to be in this state of chaos under the pretense that everything is fine. Okay, but that mentality to me is extremely dangerous. And one of the things that I immediately thought about when I listened to that, and Madasi P. Baba for sending that to me, one of the things that immediately came to mind is something I try to bear in mind all the time, and that's the audience. The audience, and I'm not that of course, though, that small sample of people is not the entire African population, but I think that they're very representative of the majority mm-hmm. of the African yes. population on this planet, where whenever anyone comes with any statement, especially somebody in entertainment or sports who are now our new intellectuals, whenever anyone comes out with a statement that exonerates Urugu, which this completely and totally did, Europeans did what they did because they had the opportunity to do it, and we'd have done the same thing if we were in their shoes mentality, because we're all human. We all come from the same stock, so we're all the same. So if Africans had the opportunity to do that to Europe, or Europeans were in Africa and Africans were in Europe and they came down and did the same thing, then you would expect that because we're all the same, that all the same mentality, and we're not all the same. So these statements not only exonerate, make Urugu okay in what they did, make Urugu normal in terms of what they did, mm-hmm. make them, you know, not enemy. They're just, you know, a little bit confused, and maybe we need to spend our lives trying to make them more human or to understand themselves better. But it also validates and makes menticide normal.
Mm. Yes.
It makes us believe, because this is the mentality, because so many of us are so afraid subconsciously. We know that Urugu will kill for nothing. We know this. We can play all kinds of whatever kind of games we want to, but we know, and we act accordingly. Just like the examples of when there's a group of black folks talking and a white person walks in, the conversation changes.
Right, exactly. They start going into a hush.
Absolutely, but the opposite doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
The opposite does not apply. So, and they don't go into that hush because somebody said, shh, here comes, you know, Urugu. No, they are, we know. Mm-hmm. I don't have that issue, but the vast majority of us know. You need to say, you need to not say anything. You see it in a post office today, where you have three or four black folks who will be talking about some issue that's going on in the community or the world, and a European will come into the post office, and it's really bad here in West End because of this regentrification.
I know, because when you say that, because I do the same post office.
And I'm listening. I'm not joining the conversation. I'm listening because I want to know what my people are thinking. But you hear them talking about it, and as soon as a European comes in and gets in line inside of those doors,
yep.
the conversation changes. Now, the topic might not change, but the references will. And mm-hmm. there's a code language that kicks in at black folks who want to continue the conversation. Okay. You see this today, now. I see this at conferences. I see this everywhere that I go, where we are. You know, you still see this. So the statements that are made, I look at the audience. And the audience, the majority of us would have been applauding him because it took European out of the context of being enemy, and it made our subservience, our drive to be subservient, our drive to believe in them, our drive to keep them at the cutting edge of solving our problems, it made that logic seem okay. I call that eureason, where we think in ways that we think in ways that Europeans would want us to think. Just like menticide is not just removing someone's mind, it's replacing it with how Europeans want us to look at ourselves. So that it's like when I'm watching the audience, and I keep saying watching the audience because that's what I do. I watch the audience regardless of what the speaker is saying, because their response tells me. And I know, yes, I know that people can be very selective in terms of their audience and who is going to be there, et cetera, but I look at the wider community, and I would see the vast majority of us who would be applauding that, because it takes the heat off of us. It makes us feel more comfortable in our fear. It makes our fear seem like it's normal and correct. It makes the idea that we have any power, you know, it removes that, because our power is their power in our mind. And whatever power they have is going to be used to the benefit of all of us, because we're all human.
Right. Well, that's just like when Smokey chose to say, I'd rather be here than anywhere else, you know.
Yes. And why? Why? It's like this is the only place, because this is European stronghold.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it would require, you know, that statement immediately takes me back to the understanding that came out really in the 70s, or the idea that was promoted in the 70s, that a lot of the lack of independent businesses and success among blacks, among us, among Africans, was because we had been trained not to want to start at the bottom. We didn't want to have to do the work, not understanding or losing the fact that when you start from the bottom, when you build from scratch, it's stronger and it's you.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely and totally stronger and it's you. So we didn't want to have to build this from scratch. So we don't want to have to deal with Africa. That's one of the reasons. We don't want to have to deal with Africa, because we see it as broken, torn, shredded, resourceless, even though we should know better. We see it as still like we saw with Johnny Weissmuller and Tarzan. Yeah. That's how we still
primitive.
See Africa.
Primitive.
That's how we still see it. Mm-hmm. So the idea of us having to go over there and save these heathens, the number of Africans in this country who are missionaries over there is amazing.
Mm-hmm. And that was the mindset. That was the mindset of us going over there to Liberia.
Absolutely.
That was the mindset. We believe that because Caucasians did what they did, that we're better, that we're smarter, you know, more religious.
Mm-hmm. And it's like discord in Liberia since then. Nothing but chaos, if you will, in Liberia since then, relative to, you know, that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want to have to go back and start from scratch and build something better than what it was. To learn from our mistakes. We don't have to learn from our mistakes. We don't consider the mistake.
Right.
I'd be willing to, you know, I mean, I'm speculating here, but I'd be willing to bet some money on more of us believing in our inferiority, more of us still believing that we were saved from barbarity.
Mm-hmm.
By the arrival of the Europeans. However much damage was done, that was what was needed to be done, just like turning your other cheek. However much damage was done to us was the damage that was necessary to bring us into civilization.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mentality that I believe that a lot of us have. I remember another study that was done in Chicago, and it was done by some graduate students under the guidance of a couple of faculty, where they looked at they did a survey of it was kind of like a self-esteem survey, but one of the focuses in that survey was the idea that Europeans are considered superior to African people. And this was done in the 80s. And they looked at black folks and they looked at white folks. And they had a very representative sample, pretty large. I believe that there were something like 6,000-7,000 people in Chicago. And what was surprising to me, what wasn't surprising to me, was that I think it was about 30% of the white folks still considered themselves to be intellectually superior to black folks just because of the color of their skin. What really threw me was the 60% of black folks who did. More of us believed that we were intellectually their superiors, even though I guess it shouldn't have been because we were trained well in this. Europeans did a good job. But the idea that this was still a belief in the 80s. So we know that it's still a belief today. It just manifests in different ways. It's become, like, mental science has become more sophisticated at a subconscious level. And it's become more sophisticated because we have stopped teaching our children about racism. We have stopped teaching our children about Urugu, so it allows Urugu to hide their racism better as they do what they do behind the scenes to maintain their dominance. Again, when I was in grad school, I didn't think that. I didn't think racism had gone anywhere. I was a little older. But I didn't think racism had gone anywhere. They were just smart enough not to show me, if you will. I think it was because I was an older student. They were just smart enough not to show me because they knew that I wasn't playing. I'm not trying to say I was all that bad and all the rest of it, but they realized I was one of those kind of people that, okay, well, you want me to think that? I don't want to think that. I'm gone. And they needed me because money was coming from the government
right.
to the university to pay for my fellowship. Mm-hmm. Anyway, at the end of your first year at University of Chicago, take a set of preliminary exams, or prelims. And these prelims are like four exams that you take where you have to write like 10-page essays answering, from a choice of, I guess it's like maybe 15 different questions in sociology. And you have the option of picking and choosing. And they gave us a list at the beginning of when we first entered, telling us, you need to be familiar with these books in order to take the exam. And there were like 127 books on that list, and I had read one of those books. So I took the next year off, and I got a job at Minolta Business Systems, and I studied on the bus there. I studied on the way back. I studied home. I studied everywhere. Anyhow, I got so sick and tired of me having index cards plastered over all of the walls in the apartment, walking around studying. So when the end of that year came, I went to take my prelims. And I took the prelims, and I passed, and I realized that it was political at that point. They didn't have time to read my answers. They just needed me. They needed that money. Because there was another brother in the department who I would argue was much, much smarter than me, much, much well-read than me. He wasn't arrogant like that, but he knew his stuff, and he had to retake two of his exams because they didn't want him in there because he was going to sociology and philosophy, and that was an area they didn't want us in. Anyway, when I took the exam, I passed the exam, and I'm on campus, a few months later, and this white girl who tried to befriend us, she, where you been? And I said, well, I went to study for the prelims because I hadn't read any of the books. And she said, what? She said, come here. She took me to the Regenstein Library. And in the Regenstein Library, you had these huge lockers, maybe 2 feet by 2 feet by 4 feet. And you rent them for the year. You can rent them for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, just like you can take out a book and you keep it for years and years and years and years. She took me to this locker, the combination locker. She turned the combination. She opened it up. There were maybe 10, 11 binders in there, fat 3-inch binders in there, full of papers. No books, just binders, full of papers. And she said, these are the exams. These are the papers
wow.
from all of the students over the years who passed the exams. She said, this is where you go. You go when you don't know. When you come here, you go to the locker and you start checking this out and you study their notes and then you go pass the exam. All of the white students knew about them. None of the black students knew anything about it. None of the black students knew anything about those binders. None of them. Okay, so she would have been considered to be a traitor, but all of the white students, all of these folks who walk around smiling,
yeah,
this more sophisticated level of mental side, all of them knew about it. All of them had used these binders, and they had systematically not told any of the black graduate students there. Of course, I took the binders out. I made copies of it, went back to, down to Minolta Business System, made copies of the binder, put the binders back, and passed on the binders to the next class. Okay, but the idea that because you don't see it, that they're not actively engaged in domination is the biggest lie, the biggest farce that's been perpetrated on black folks in the year 2022 imaginable. And we need to talk about in the labor market, the car dealership in Houston, Texas knows just as well as the car dealership in St. Louis, Missouri, knows just as well as the car dealership in Seattle, Washington, the one in Brooklyn, New York. They know, all of them know full well you're supposed to rip black folks off when they're buying a new or used car. You're supposed to charge them more interest. You're supposed to charge them more for the car. You're supposed to try to direct them toward the more expensive, fancier models of the car. They know this, and they're not sitting on the phone with each other.
You know,
they're not going to conferences and discussing this.
Right. It is something that is systemic, because you can look at newsreels or exposés or stuff like that from 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's the same damn thing.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're trying to pretend by not talking about it, we're trying to pretend that it goes away. That's that Negro logic. If we don't talk about it, if we don't look at it, somehow it's going to
disappear.
It's going to disappear. Yeah. So our children, and when push comes to shove, and if you will, when all heaven breaks loose, it's going to be seriously ugly, because our children are not going to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When Katrina hit New Orleans, and the brothers who got shot trying to get back into their neighborhood, their predominantly white neighborhood, they found out then, and I'm sure that the story, and they presented, did a documentary on that a little bit after Katrina.
Right.
And the brothers who got shot on the bridge by the cops and other stuff, it takes that for us to register, but we have become so blind, subconsciously blind to the possibility of Europeans being Europeans, that we might listen to the story and say, oh, yeah, but we're looking at a few bad apples. We're looking at that one or two or three Europeans who did this here, one or two Europeans who did this in Sacramento, the one or two, three Europeans who did this. We don't understand that this is the nature of a people, and that takes me back immediately to this idea that we're all African. We quickly, right. I hear Negroes quickly say that. We're all African. We're all African. And even if that is true, even if monogenesis is true, then we need to seriously qualify that, because the qualification is greater in terms of its impact on us as a people than the bloodline if all of us came from that one person and the Cro-Magnon factor wasn't involved.
Yeah. That's why I liked the Caucasian Michael Bradley's book.
Iceman.
Yeah, Iceman's Inheritance.
Iceman's Inheritance.
We're going to take a break, Baba. And when we come back from the break, we're going to open up the lines and, you know, further this deep discussion on, you know, because in today's society right now, this is what's happening. When you hear Caucasians talking about challenging critical race theory, when you hear them talking about, we don't want you to study this and we don't want you to talk about this and so forth, they want to control and dominate the narrative, and they definitely don't want your perspective. They just want you to shut up, go along, to get along, and be happy, you know.
As they go about the business of changing our story.
Exactly, and dominating us. You know,
absolutely.
So, yeah. So, brothers and sisters, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blackTalkRadioNetwork.com. But before I go, I want to say this. This past weekend's Us Lifting Us conference, which was held virtually, was outstanding. And I want to give good props to Baba Akima and all the brothers and sisters of Us Lifting Us around the country and actually around the world, even though we're small in numbers. But the idea and the concept of cooperative economics is vitally important. And so we've dealt with some good issues. So right on to Us Lifting Us. Brothers and sisters, we'll be right back. You stay with us, and we'll have more conversation. I'm going to play a piece by Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers from back in 1961. That's right. That's right, brothers and sisters. Art Blakey and Jazz Messengers, The Night in Tunisia from 1961 in Japan. Art Blakey on drums. Lee Morgan on trumpet. Wayne Shorter on sax. Bobby Timmons on piano. And Jimmy Merritt on bass. Brothers and sisters, the Jazz Messengers. Tunisia, January 1961. Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. I tell you, I love it. Let me see. Get all right. That's Art Blakey on drums, Lee Morgan on trumpet, Wayne Short on sax, Bobby Timmons on piano, and Jimmy Merritt on bass. Man, love it. Let's get back to the discussion. We have Baba Baruti, and like I said, always a pleasure to have Baba Baruti. I know he's a busy man, you know, and I appreciate you taking the time away from your busy schedule and educational schedule. I mean, this you're a prolific writer, great educator, and, you know, I tell you, it's an honor to have you always, you know, be on the program and to have conversation with you, Baba.
I appreciate the invite. I said, I'm pretty busy, but yeah. There are some things that busyness doesn't, you know, preclude. It doesn't. This is necessary. This is good. This is, as you say back in the day, this is good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's absolutely. Why we, you know, this time you contacted me to let me know, you know, because I'm always contacting you and say, when can you come? You said, hey, I'm letting you know. I got this time available. Let's do it. I said, let's do it.
Yeah, and, absolutely. It had been a while.
Yeah.
I thought you had forgotten about me.
Never. Never. Never.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, we see each other also off the program. So,
yes.
You know, this is family.
You know it. And I appreciate it. You know, there, like I said, the, you know, aside from what Smokey Robinson said and that mindset, and it's so pervasive, you know, I'm of the opinion, and I've felt this way for some time, that, you know, we shouldn't even use the word black. Because just as Dr. Clark said, you should always, when you use the word to describe a people, you must conjure land, history, and culture. There is no black land, you know. There's Africa. We're Africans, you know. Just like Caucasians aren't white. They're Europeans. Right. They're not white, but they're the ones that chose to use the word collective whiteness to impose it on the world. And so we've taken that, the idea of their collective whiteness has some, and just like Ozzie Davis said, the English language is my enemy.
Absolutely.
Because when he looked up that word, and Dr. King did the same thing, and Muhammad Ali did the same. We all know how the Europeans use the word white to describe pureness and holiness, and you know, and black is something sullied and evil and demented. So the bottom line is, we need to talk about culture and history. And so we must use the words. We're African. In fact, there's a problem now with African, with saying, well, we're not African. We're the word should be El Kabilan, or the word should be Ethiopian. So there's a lot of conflict within us, and I've been battling this, man, you know, because I always want to come on this program and put out the information that brings some clarity to some issues that we as a people have, and say, this is the direction that we must go. You know, and I'm not, Baba, I'm not saying this is me. Because, you know, this is not my opinion. This is based on what you and other scholars and historians have told us, the ones that I recognize, the ones that I admire and respect, those men and women who, without foundation money and grant money and so forth, reclaimed, recaptured, restored this history. Just like Drusilla Dungey Houston, when she wrote in 1926, the wonderful Ethiopians of the ancient Kushite Empire, she says, I have dug up an irrefutable arsenal of facts that Harvard and Yale or even cowardly scholarship in our race can dare not refute. And the most important part of the quote is, how can a leadership point the way forward that is utterly ignorant of the past? And see, and that's the ignorance that Smokey, I'm just keeping it real, that he displayed. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We have been reduced to the point where puppetry is real for those who have that clarity that you speak of, where we can see that the voices that we are listening to are the voices that they have put up. The voices that, you know, we have people who I dare say have not read anything on our story or their story, who are the leaders or whose voices are considered to be credible in terms of explaining us or in terms of explaining our condition or explaining the direction that we need to take,
mm-hmm.
and those who are actually doing the work are not. But I remember in the 80s, watching for the deck for the duration of the 80s, because with the 70s it began its decline. Like in early 70s, it began its decline. The you know revolutionary black thinking
yeah.
in academia, and I watched in the 80s the removal of revolutionary faculty from colleges and universities across the country in that one decade, because they didn't want to hear that voice. And of course, the voices that they allowed in were those who were most Yorugu user friendly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's now that's in place.
That's in, it's firmly it's entrenched.
That's in place. So the mm-hmm. people now who are the quote unquote revolutionaries in many instances, and that's not to say that that is a complete and total washout. You know, I know some people who are in academia who aren't playing, but for the most part, their voices are drowned out by those who are Negroes and lost souls. And that is, this has been, you know, systematic. This isn't accidental. This was planned. Just like regentrification was planned. This was planned. So now we are being led by, you got to imagine, no other people on the planet. We are being led by entertainers.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're talking about, because sports is entertainment for Europeans, we're being led by entertainers in the media, on the field, in the court, on the court, what have you. We're being led by them. Their voices are looked up to by, I want to say not just young folk, young and old, as being the most articulate of our menticidal mentality.
Mm.
They are seen as the authorities. So when you hear the voice of someone like a Chancellor Williams or a Drusilla Dungy Houston, when you hear their voices, you look at them like they're crazy. They got to be psychotic, neurotic at best, but they've got to be psychotic. You got mm-hmm. a problem with Europeans. You got a problem mm-hmm. with what they did in history. That wasn't them. We're all Africans, so we all did that. It's all our mistakes. So when you, it's like now with the getting off on the tangent. So you stop me wherever you want to, Bubba. But I look at this pollution thing and the global quote unquote global warming, which is a misnomer. And every time you hear a report, and it grinds at me, I don't grip my teeth, but it grinds at me when they say, you know, look at what we did. No look what you
y'all did.
Did.
Look, yes.
For to be part of it.
Yeah.
But we've adopted that what we did mentality, which completely and totally clears them. Mm-hmm. And, of course, all the pictures that we see are of them with their little blue gloves on cleaning up beaches someplace.
Mm-hmm.
so the that we are all human, that, and the language thing that Ossie Davis, that's one of the best articles I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
The language thing that Ossie Davis talked about, Malcolm, of course, reading the dictionary from front to back, which I tried unsuccessfully, at least the Webster's Collegiate I tried unsuccessfully. The meaning, the connotation, the denotation, the connotation of black and white. When the 60s and 70s kick in, there was all this uproar about get rid of G.I. Joe and get rid of Barbie because they were pushing the children in a particular direction, blah blah blah, by white folks, and that's back. Of course, that came back through the games. It died out for a second so that the noise, the clamor could stop. The same thing happened with the relationship of bad to black and white to good. Versus it's coming back now. You're hearing mm-hmm. references to black and dark and all the rest of that because there's no one that they're listening to who has continued that understanding where they're using the language against us and we're using the same language in the same way because we haven't redefined it. We haven't reconceptualized it for our children. So our children, we're falling back into that cycle again, that language thing that you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing the same references in the same ways that I heard in the 60s. I'm hearing again now. I'm seeing the G.I. Joe and the Barbie doll. They've returned. So it's like you waited for those voices that were upset or, you know, to quiet down as well as, you know, you placated some of them. You made everything good for them, et cetera. But these things are back. That's why I'm talking about a more heinous, a more pernicious subconscious mm-hmm. mental side, because we are buying into this, you know, we're all African. So, you know, one of the things, Baba, that really occurred to me a number of years ago is that Europeans, and, you know, many of our scholars say Europeans never produce or never say or do anything that doesn't benefit Europeans. So it's like a child outside of a candy store, and the child wants the candy store so bad that when you let the child in the candy store, they go eat the candy, which is what you had planned anyway. So what Europeans did was they took this racist inferiority that they were given to African people. They made us want to fight that so badly because we were still centered around changing their minds. So we had all these scholars going around the world talking about racism, irrelevant, blah, blah, blah. All of these black scholars. The white scholars are pretty quiet on it. Mm-hmm. But all these black scholars running around talking about racism, irrelevant, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, Europeans acquiesce and they're beginning to say, yeah, well, you know, it's a non-scientific category, et cetera, et cetera. But it's like you've been led into this trap. So all of that has led to Europeans saying, okay, well, if we're all Africans, and they started this mess, if we're all Africans, then that means Africa is all of our homeland. So you have no more right mm-hmm. to being on the African continent than
they
do.
That's right. Mm.
You know, and that's politics. Mm-hmm. That's politics. And we fell for it because of our condition, but we haven't wakened up from that yet. Mm-hmm. We're still, the folks in that audience are more than likely to stand up, give a standing ovation to a European who was born in Africa saying, I'm African.
Mm-hmm.
As they, you know, they were to Smokey Robinson's statement, which essentially said that.
Right. Well, listen, we're going to open up these phone lines. Brothers and sisters, you can, those in the queue, there's a number of you. Hit star twice. Hit star twice, and that'll let you in for any questions, comments, or concerns. And for those who are listening, dial 215-490-9832. Dial 215-490-9832. Caller 404-453. Caller, good afternoon.
Hey, Yehudu, Oshie, and my man Bob. Hey, y'all throw so much on the table, man. I don't know where to start.
You know where to start, man. About the research West,
the word
brothers
thing,
and sisters.
With the word thing. Yeah. Our words are magic wand. So me, I eliminate can't, won't, and don't from my vocabulary. That's the first thing. And then some words that we use it from them, like the damn picnic, a kid, what do I call it, true kids, like their damn billy goat, mm-hmm. and how you doing, brother, I'm hanging. What the hell is that? You hanging off a tree that lick your ass? And then the slick word they use is a word called gal. You ever heard that gal name before, gal?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, y'all know the origin of that gal word is, right?
What's that?
That's when they had the sister being the wet nurse for the ass. She a gal. She gave up a gallon of milk. That's why anytime they talking and they say gal, they talking about a sister.
Oh, okay. She was a wet nurse. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gal. She gave up a gallon of milk, man.
Okay.
But and the question I want to ask y'all, but the main thing, what I'm thinking about doing is getting on GoFundMe, getting a GoFundMe account, and say, send big black Wesley back to Africa and see how many folks going to put it, white folks going to put it in my account. Like Richard Pryor did in that skit. Back in the 70s. So I'm about ready to put me a GoFundMe account and see to send me back to Africa. I'll wait for somebody to do that, man. I guess I got to be the trash that dummy and do it. To see. And if I get enough money, I'm showing up out of here.
You'll be on your home in about a week.
Yeah. Yeah,
but the saddest thing I saw me and you talked about is Ocean. Okay, about this, I want to ask the brother that you two Ocean again about this Ryan Coogler thing going to the white folk Bank of America, and then damn black people the one called the police on it, man. What y'all think about that, man?
Because they're trained to. They're trained
Absolutely.
To. If somebody comes into the bank, you know, and especially now because of masks and so forth, pushes a note asking for a huge sum of money. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know who this person is, so I'm calling the cops, I'm calling the authorities, I'm calling the management. You know, I'm just a lowly bank teller. But, yeah, everybody, you're right. You're right, Brother West. Everybody in the bank was black. And even the cops that showed up was black. You know, was us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And the police pulled a gun out on the brother, man.
Yeah.
He pulled a pistol out and pulled a Glock at him, man.
Well, yeah, because he was robbing the bank. Because it was
in fear.
What the? What the hell, man?
And we have to protect the masses' interests. We move in fear, even in a black bank, even if it was a black bank, you know, we still see it as our money.
Mm-hmm.
We see it as a possession of Europeans, and that's something that we need to protect.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to get caught in the fallout of anything involved in that. So we're going to bend over backwards to make sure that we're not in trouble because we know we're in trouble already.
Man, I used to work for Wells Fargo, man. I used to be security guard for Wells Fargo. And people coming to take every damn thing. They tried to get me on the money truck. I said, I be goddamn, I'm gonna be on y'all truck, guard y'all money, get killed for y'all money. I refuse that job, man. But some of my black people, man, I just say like smoking them. I'm like my man Nelly Fuller now. The Negroes have showed themselves. They said what they said, and I can't get upset by them saying stupid stuff. And you right, man. They don't want no more. I'm gonna say this. I'm gonna let somebody talk.
All right.
They don't want no more. They don't want no Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Russell, Jimmy Brown. They don't want that now, man. They done dumbed down the Negro athletes now, man. Back in the day, y'all remember them?
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
But anyhow, that's all right. Thing to think about, man. I don't want to hold the line up. I'm enjoying the conversation. I know y'all. Man. Oh yeah, I want to thank you and Jay, man. What y'all said. Good words about me Friday, man. Especially Jay. I'm surprised. You almost made my eyes start sweating, man. My eyes almost start sweating, man. I was shocked. But I love y'all, man.
You too, brother.
Bill, I'm going to say this right here. Biden talking about Bill Back Better. I say Bill Black Better.
Right.
Y'all going to Bill Africa Back Better.
That's right.
Anyway, we going to win, man.
Always.
We going to win, bro. We got it. We got it, man.
All right, Wes. Research Wes. Thank you,
continue.
Bro. You bet.
That's all.
Absolutely.
646-646, good afternoon.
Hotep,
brother Jay.
To both of y'all warriors. Hotep. Hey, Wes, in regards to your GoFund, just use your little video clip of you and Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Saying you love America and you'll get mighty donations to send you back. Well, listen, Baba Baruti, as always, it's an honor. How are you doing, my brother?
You and the queen? How you doing?
I'm doing good, brother. I can't complain. It don't help none. You know
Absolutely.
What I mean? Our situation Absolutely. Is this question that I'm about to ask you right now. Two things. Number one, what is your take with what's going on with these psychopaths dressing up our men in these so-called kilts and dresses and skirts and high-heeled shoes and all of this nonsense? What do you think the end game with that is at this present time they're working on?
Now, you know that will require hours to deal with. Of course, if it wasn't you, I'd send folks to read Homosexuality and the Effeminization of African Males. But it's an escalated advanced stage of this effeminization process. And Francis Welsing, other folks made it, you know, they made it common, what should be common sense, quite plain. I said European males, when they deal with war, when they see an enemy, they know they need to deal with the men. And that's what they target in terms of turning them into something that they are not. So if you can effeminize all black males, or the majority of black males, if you can make them turn them against their roles and their responsibilities, you don't have to worry about them as a threat. You know, you can go ahead and go through the process of completely eliminating them, committing that act of genocide, final genocide against them, but you don't have to worry about them as a threat because they don't see themselves as men. They don't see themselves in the role of men. They don't see themselves as providers and protectors of African people. So when you confuse them as to their role, role confusion, when you confuse them as to their role, then you psychologically eliminate a threat. You psychologically eliminate the possibility of them rising against you, of organizing in such a way that they are one who understands that you are the enemy. You know, this process has been in long going. You put a group of them behind bars. You kill a group of them. You put a group of them on drugs. You put a group of them in an intellectual setting where they are completely and totally isolated from their own people and see and feel no sense of accountability. And then you get the generation that's coming, and you effeminize them. You make them, not only do you remove from them the knowledge of their role as providers and protectors, which they pretty much don't see in the home, because for many of our boys, the provider and protector in the home is the woman. And, of course, for us African people, we know that the black woman has always been in that role, serve the role of provider and protector, but the man's role, his role, has always been to provide him and to protect, period. Mother also had the nurturing role. She also had the bringing of children into this into this reality role, but the men's primary role was to provide and to protect. And when you don't see that role, and when Western culture has it so that they want to play, pretend that there's no such thing as roles that are sex-based, that are based upon, you know, our story and the logic and the reason behind it, which, of course, that also makes our ancestors stupid, because they obviously didn't know what they were doing in terms of establishing roles. I'm not talking about what we see on the continent in most places now, because that's imitation of what Europeans brought in terms of the sex role. That's not our tradition. That's European imposed tradition. When you don't have that model to look at, when you don't have that role model to look at, then you're looking everywhere else. And, of course, our children are being socialized through the media, which is controlled and directed by Europeans, and that media is anti-African. So that media, the last thing that media wants is our sons to grow up to be men, or our daughters to grow up to be women, in fact. They want the confusion where there is no sexual difference. So you have these promotions, these slap-in-the-face promotions of the opposite of what they should be. We always seem to forget that everything is political. Every single solitary thing is political. So we want to pretend when they started having the men wear pink that it was just, you know, that's just another color. Okay, but we understood when I was coming up that that was a color, that was a domain of women. That was a domain of girls. That didn't mean that a brother might not have on a pink shirt or use a pink washcloth or what have you. But the politics of it today, because it's been taken out of that context of us building family, of us building community, of men being men, if you will, women being women, if you will. When it's taken out of that context, then you have this blending which allows for an absence of role identification, an absence of a definite role for men, an absence of a definite role for women. And none of that involves the idea, which, of course, they play with the politics. None of that involves the idea that there are certain things that boys can do that girls can't do. We've essentially never really had that problem. Once involved with this, we might have had that problem to some degree, but we've never had that problem. That's been a white issue, where girls were not allowed to do this and boys were not allowed to do that. I didn't grow up in that environment. I didn't see that with the girls. The girls did what they chose to do. The boys did what they chose to do relative to their role, and not relative to their role. But this effeminization process, this is like the last of the major desexualization processes that exists, because once you have broken boys from their role as men, then that's what they're going to teach whatever boys come along. So you're going to see the opposite of what they're saying is the problem, where if you don't cry as a boy because of whatever, then something's wrong with you. You're hyper-masculinated. You know, so you have this reversal, which, you know, is different when you are the people who have your finger on that, the launching of the thermonuclear warheads. Mm. You know, you can be homosexual, you can be effeminate, like in Greece and in Rome, But you got to look, even in Rome, they had codified laws written in the books against effeminate males being part of the military. It's in the book. Look it up. And they had laws against effeminate males. Of course, homosexual, you couldn't go against because that's what they were. That's what they are. But you had actual laws in the book that permitted, excuse me, that made it so that if you were a feminized male, if you were the dependent male in a homosexual relationship, if you were the effeminate male, then you couldn't serve in their military, which says a lot about what they understand about effeminacy among males. So you're having that process now relative to our military, because to me there's no such thing as civilians in war. Relative to our military forces, you are creating a people who are completely and totally demilitarized. And it's already bad enough that we refuse to establish that institution in our community. We refuse to even protect our community, but we refuse to establish that in our community. We refuse to establish that in most of the societies that we are in. And even when we do, it's dependent upon European approval. We refuse to establish it, and now taking it to the next level, if you establish it, you wouldn't have the stupid people you could recruit to do that because the males are so feminized. They're more concerned about you know, their appearance and what they look like than they are about learning how to deal with enemies. And at the same time, you're having a major rise in the number of white children, particularly white girls, who are learning survival and weaponry. I tell the warriors in training all the time, okay, you don't have to believe if you don't want to. Go online and search gun competition for children. And you're going to see white children, particularly white girls, training. And it's not just to develop their discipline or their character, what have you. Europeans have always been preparing for war. In medieval Europe, they talked about, they used the words, state of perpetual war. They use that phrase, state of perpetual war, to describe. Europeans are always involved in or preparing for war, and we're preparing for peace. We're trying to pretend like we're going to either they're going to be protecting us, or, you know, we're for some same reason we're not going to be involved, or if we're involved and we're going to be honored in the same way. It's like it doesn't. I remember my father, other folks talking about the Confederate flags in Vietnam, huge ones, not just, you know, little patches or, you know, in their little space, you know, huge ones above the tents where white boys were. So we don't understand, well, we don't understand that we're in a state of war. And when you don't understand that you're a state of war and your mind is controlled by your enemy, then you think that you're a state of peace, which is that rhetorical ethic. Or partially a rhetorical ethic that Mama Rim was talking about, where they give you the illusion that they are about peace on earth and goodwill toward all men,
right?
When really they're about the idea of domination. They make
well, they're showing that right now.
Yes.
They're showing that right now over in Europe, and I don't have no problem with it at all. The more and more and more that they kill each other, the better and better it may be for us at some point in time. But you know, Baba, my second question to you is this. Mm-hmm. With all that you just said, first of all, I don't think we as African people collectively on the whole even realize we at war. We think that we've been somewhat liberated to, you know, be close to master. So, you know, when we talk about that, that's like something foreign. It's like watching these Negroes on TV reporting the news, and it just disgusts me, man. It's absolutely mind-boggling. But you know what I really would like for you to say to the family this afternoon is, what is victory for us?
One word: sovereignty. I can add on multiple words. Complete and total, utter sovereignty. Complete and total. And people will say, of course, the Mentecito will say, oh, well, that's not possible. How can you do that? So since when? It's like, how can genius use the word can't? You know, we can do anything else, but suddenly when it comes to the sovereignty of African people, this is something that we can't do. We can't do things that will make us be under our own control, that will take us out from under the foot of Yorugu. When we start talking about things like that, then we can't, suddenly somehow we can't do that. And I'm not a believer in that. But I do know that African people, go ahead.
Baba, let me ask you this. You say that victory is sovereignty. I totally agree with you. I mean, you know, to me, the word sovereignty and culture are two of some of the most important words that we could ever speak. Agreed. But in all honesty, Baba, and you know, I value everything that you say beyond, you know, mostly anybody at this time.
Okay,
if there was 10 of us, in all honesty, from your perspective, Baba, how many out of that 10 know what sovereignty is?
One.
One.
Yeah, and we're way down at the bottom when it comes to believing in us, believing in the possibility, to see how many of our scholars have said we can't imagine a world where Europeans aren't in charge.
That's crazy.
We can't imagine that. I told students years ago, we can't even imagine an angel unless it's a black angel, unless it's like the angel of death. I said, so that means for you all who believe in that, none of your relatives made it to heaven, because we can't even imagine a black angel. So we
definitely, you know, it's part of the grandpa syndrome. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That's the greatest scholar, one of the person that opened up my eyes almost 40 years ago when I read his book, and I always tell his story, was Haki Madhubuti. He had one paragraph or one basic sentence in the book. He said that the white man is your perpetual enemy, and it changed my whole life. I asked him 30 years later, did he still feel that way? And he said no, and the only thing that helped me get through that was my brother said, you know, he's suffering from grandpa syndrome. And that's the only thing that, you know, helps me deal with that type of betrayal that he put forward on that level. But, I mean, I don't understand how you write something 40 years ago and then over a period of time, and you're supposed to be a warrior, you change your mind to have the most profound statement that you could basically ever make or want in regards to the Yorugu, change your mind about it. I still have trouble dealing with it mentally, to be honest with you.
Yeah, both of us do, and I pray that never happens to me. And in fact, I wrote an essay in Menticide called High Treason, which was a discussion of that, because Haki was, he had a new concept. He and his wife, Safisha, had a new concept development center in Chicago, which is cool. Our daughter went there, okay, with Men in Society, which is a course that I taught at Morehouse for 6 years. His black men was required reading. So was Naeem Akbar's Changing Images until I found out stuff.
Right.
But
we're not going to talk about that.
Yeah, and the sad thing for me is I can't go back and tell those students, you know, rethink this. But I remember running to the store to get a hardback copy of Haki's Claiming Earth, because, you know, the hardbacks, they go fast, and you need to get them early. So I ran to the store, get a copy of Claiming Earth, hadn't heard anything, and I open up the book, and I start reading, and, you know, I'm thumbing through, and I come across the poem, White People Are People Too. And it threw me to the other side of the planet. I did not understand how someone who was so clear in plan all the rest of these books that he had written before then, black men, I could not, Clash of the Races, I could not understand who somebody who understood it to in that way could flip like that. And at that same time, I said, I pray that never happens to me, that I don't lose my mind in that way because of money and other stuff. And of course, I was around them. I worked with Safisha Madhubuti on what was called the Bethune Institute, where she was, you know, I was under her working with mothers who were single mothers. I said, our daughter went there.
Well, you know, one book that was one book that I used to recommend
thing,
to my.
Oh,
that, hold on, Jay.
Oh,
that
was, last thing, right quick.
Hold on, let me just say this right quick.
Let me ask you this, Baba.
Go ahead.
let me ask you this last thing. Baba, when you hear things of that nature and knowing your position in the community, do at any point in time, do y'all sit down and talk with one another and try to work this those statements out and ask, how do you come to that type of conclusion? You know, because to me, I would just like to know, even though my boy called it grandpa syndrome, just basically he want to be here to see his grandkids live and enjoy and play with them and all that, which is whatever. But the point is, do y'all ever get a chance to sit down as African men and go through back and forwards these type of debates? Because I remember coming up, I would always see Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark, Carruthers, and all of them go back and forwards in regards to having debate. You know, not nothing out of the way, respectful and all of that, but they would discuss these things amongst one another if they said something. But that was back in the 80s, so it was a whole different climate than what it is today. It's 40 years later. But I just wanted to do you ever get a chance to just, because y'all know each other, sit down and just talk and say, how do you get to this position that's so dramatically different from what you tried to teach our people? And as always, Bobby, it's an honor, man, to speak with you. Hotel.
All right, Jay. Thank you, brother.
Well, that was my immediate response, even though it will require a long, drawn-out explanation, my immediate response is no, I don't have time. And I'm not trying to say that selfishly or arrogantly, like I'm all of that, and I don't have time to talk about these issues. But I haven't seen any of these debates as anything more than in this time. Like you said, that was a different time. But now I don't see them as any more as distraction, because the people who you're talking to in most cases, they've made up their minds. So they don't come into the debate to have a debate. Their whole objective is to convince you that you're wrong. And then you have, if you're talking about it in a public arena, then the audience is already, you know, Oprah style. So you're already wrong. But I don't, it's like the pain from that. I really don't have a conversation, because my idea of you as a man meant that you stood in a particular way, that you didn't change just because you got older. Your grandchildren should be prouder of you if you died because you stood your ground and you didn't change it for some money, which I've seen so many people do, change for that money, change for that prestige. Okay, there's stuff that went on with Haki at Chicago State, which is very interesting to me. So it's like somebody who betrays you. I don't have time for the conversation.
Right on.
Okay, you know exactly what you did. You're grown. You've been talking this truth for I don't know how long.
Right.
And you're switching up because of some money or because you want this particular chair or this position at a college or university, or because, you know, it's going to increase your sales, or is it because it's going to allow you to get a grant so that you can have a charter school. Okay, so for me, the conversation is over. It's like, for me, we have spent so much time, and this does not negate the idea of having conversations, discussions, debates, if you will, with people who are trying to find their way. Okay, someone asked me years ago, well, why did you stop teaching college? You know, you start, you know, teaching young folk. And I said, because most of the young folks who are in college, most of the quote-unquote adults who are in college, their minds are already set. They already know, and in most cases, I was dealing with most of them are Negroes. They already know that. They're clear on that. But children are impressionable to the degree, and their curiosity is strong enough so that you can give them information and ideas, and they won't dismiss them out of hand without doing at least an investigation in real life, trying to get an understanding in real life. So to me, it's beyond righteous rage, where you're supposed to be a spokesperson for our people, and the damage that you've done by putting this out on paper, and you have tens of thousands of readers, and a lot of them, they're not necessarily great thinkers, but they take what you say, and that's why they read what you wrote, because they think that you have a mind worthy of consideration. And then you do this flip. And our closes with this. I saw him in the Madu bookstore here in Atlanta a few years after that was written, and he knows my face, and I know his face. And he turned away, and all I saw on his face was shame.
Mm-hmm. I saw him, too.
He turned his face away. He knew exactly who I was. He turned his face away. When he turned his face, I saw shame. That's what I saw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw him. He came here for Malcolm X in the park, over at the park. Yeah.
Okay.
And I know how he came to Milwaukee way back in the 70s, late 70s. So I know him from some time, and saw him at the airport one time. Me and him sat down and talked. But, yeah, it's the same thing. Let me catch this other caller. Caller 334, 334, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, brothers. And Brother Oshi, you've done it again. To bring on Baba Baruti, it's a pleasure to hear you. I know time is short. Sure wish you were back here in Montgomery, Alabama, on the campus of Alabama State University, so I can sit underneath your tutelage and instruction on you reason. Still palming through that work. I kind of stopped off at the chapter 3 there about the evolutionary science and was looking to the godless reason, and I'm like, oh, man, I need some help. But it's always a pleasure to hear from you, sir. And hopefully we'll get a chance to shake hands and meet and greet one another again.
Absolutely.
Best to you and your family and your work, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Ted. Appreciate you, my brother. And you know I do, man.
See, sir.
That's my good brother, Brother Ted Lusk, out of Montgomery, Alabama. In fact, I said as soon as this stuff starts to die down, I'm going to make a specific trip to Montgomery to go to the initiative and the museum and to break bread with Brother Ted Lusk. He always sends me good stuff, man, too. Baba Baruti, our time is almost up, man, and I know I can't hold you overtime because I know how busy you are, you know.
Yeah.
But I really do.
We got class today, so
yeah.
Always the students. Always the students.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have taken the task of entrusting the minds of our youth to be the warriors that they need to be for our future. And that's serious. That is dead serious. Because, you know, yeah. Because the amount of Negroes that have been trained is tremendous. That's what I'm saying about us wanting to be black. You know, we don't want to be African. We want to be black. And being black is just is wanting the same thing that whites have. You really want to be white in black face.
Yes.
You know, that's what you really want to be. You know,
mm-hmm.
You want the cars, you want the, you know. And see, here in Atlanta is really a trip because you have gated communities and subdivisions and cul-de-sacs with nobody but us.
Yes.
You know, the lawns are manicured. I'm quite mm-hmm. sure the inside the house is immaculate. But yet, they're individualistic, and that's our problem because we live in a society that perpetuates that, and so they don't pull no money together. What if those brothers and sisters in those communities says, hey, listen, let's pull our money together and have a mall down the street where we can go to the grocery store, where we can have some places to employ our young people, where we can go to a furniture store. You know, when I first came here, Baba, I moved in DeKalb County. In Tucker, and I was going to the hospital over there off of Decatur, and in that area are Indians, and them Indians have their jewelry store. In fact, they have a strip mall. The Indians have a strip mall with everything that they want. They have the fine dining, the takeout, the grocery store, the jewelry store, the furniture store. They have everything they need right there.
They own it.
And we ain't got nothing like that.
Even in these malls that we think are ours.
Right.
Look what they did to the Madu bookstore.
Yeah.
Moved it around the corner to this kind of indescript area, which is hard to find, and they're adding on, putting in her place another jewelry spot. But it's not us that own it.
Right.
But we act like it is because it's a black place. It's
right.
The same thing in Prince George's County, which is supposed to be the place where you have the highest paid, you know,
black folks,
black people in the country, African
right.
people in the country.
That's right.
And there's no malls owned by us there. There's no gas stations owned by us there.
Yeah.
You
see?
Know, so we have bought it hook, line, and our idea of power is being the Joneses everybody's trying to keep up with, that conspicuous consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Being seen, you know, that's where we be being influential, not being powerful, being influential. We misinterpret that as power because of the fear. We know.
We got one sister coming in, and so let me try to get this sister in.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, my sister. How you doing?
And peace and blessings.
Sister
program about Baruti, you are just a phenomenal warrior. You speak the truth, and you're elevating the people, shining a light, and we are so appreciative of you. And, I mean, you just the work you do is so profound and so meaningful and so necessary. And I just say, oh, wow, I can listen to Baba Baruti. He's speaking the truth. He's speaking what I'm feeling, and, you know, and we're doing the work. So I want to say Asante Sana to you. It is Sister Haiba, by the way. My brother.
I guess. I was going to say, Mama Haiba, I recognize your voice.
Yes, yes, yes. And I wanted to, your phenomenal book that you put out, yes. You all going to tell us about, can you?
Oh, yeah, Identity.
About this Identity book?
Yes,
yes.
Identity, yes.
Yes, this is the time, if you could just tell us on the program, because, I mean, you shed light to us, and, you know, I'm just saying, I was just asking about that, and peace and love and blessings to you.
Thank you, Sister Haiba.
Blessings to you, Mama Haiba. Yeah. Wow, and Baba, I have pretty much run out of time. Maybe, maybe I could come back on.
You sure can.
And we can talk about the book. I'm in doing a course on it now.
Right.
I'd love to talk about the book, obviously.
Right.
And we can go into a little detail because everything we talked about today is addressed in there in some way, shape, form, fashion.
Yeah.
We're talking about our identity.
Right. So, so I know you're doing that every Wednesday in the evening time, and I think next week Wednesday is the last class.
Yeah,
next week Wednesday.
Last week is the last class for that.
Yeah,
of the course. But again, I'd love to come on and talk to folks about that.
Yeah, and you have comments. You have Common Sense Security coming up April.
That's very important.
Yeah.
And that's family, men, women, children, family. Each time that I've done that, Common Sense Security, it's been extremely well attended. And this one's going to be April the 16th.
The 16th, okay. I promote any and everything that you do on this program because that's what this program is about. This program is about independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people because we believe there is no other discussion. There is no other choice. In fact, the model of this program is Pan-Africanism or perish, unify or die. That's it. You bet.
It's not complicated.
All right, Baba Baruti, thank you so much. I appreciate
you so
much. All right,
Baba, I appreciate you having me on. I've enjoyed myself again.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm looking forward to my next coming on.
Oh, you bet. I look forward to it as well. Peace, Baba Baruti.
Okay.
Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of these programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, you have a blessed and wonderful day. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fortier. Bibi Fortier means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. Peace, family. You have a wonderful day, and I hope to see you and hear from you on Wednesday. All right.